I ought to hang out with you more often.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Beverly Hills 90210, not 8, 9, Dave. Today's episode is season 10, episode... I'm going to start that over.
Okay.
Where would that even be? Like, Utah?
I don't know. My brain just went to 8 for some reason.
I ought to hang out with you more often.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Beverly Hills 90210. Today's episode is season 10, episode 16, The Final Proof. And now here are your hosts, Tara Ariano and Sarah D. Bunting.
Last Valentine's Day with the gang, Sarah.
Thank God. It's actually episode 16, and my heart sank when he said episode 6, because I, for a split second, was like, oh, shit, we still have like 40 episodes to go in the season. No.
No, we still have 10, though.
Oh, yeah, 16. Should I do that over again?
Nah.
What if I went back and edited it in there, but left all this?
Your call.
16.
Very convincing. Let us begin, shall we?
Yes. Yes.
With our C plot, David is way too territorial with Camille. Donna has asked David and Camille to work the store the next day. Hire an employee, you nitwit. Just a note here. We've been rewatching Cheers, and it never occurred to me in all of the many, many, many years that I watched it when it was actually on that 4 people work at Cheers. That's not enough.
Yeah, no, it's really not. And one of them is usually very pregnant. Hire someone else.
Yeah. Anyway, same thing as at Donna's store. Like, Kelly is gone. Like, maybe you could argue you didn't both need to be there all the time. Like, probably you didn't. You could trade off, but like, Kelly's gone. You need to hire someone anyway. David says he will work at Donna's store in exchange for advice on a Valentine's Day gift for Camille. Donna rules that a cashmere sweater from Fred Siegel, which he had in mind, is expensive. He knows, but thinks that Camille is ready to be swept off her feet. Didn't he meet her, like, last week?
Yeah. Also, with a sweater?
Yeah, really. Donna says she prefers a handmade card describing one that, it turns out, is what David gave her for their first Valentine's Day and makes a dumb face remembering it, obviously. At the store the next day, David and Camille are really earning all the money that Donna is surely not paying them, just sitting at the cash desk watching people shop. Camille comments that she's never had a good Valentine's Day. David wants to change that by cooking her dinner tonight. She coos that he doesn't have to, and way too quickly he says he wants to, and she's like, okay. And then there's some slab of meat in the doorway that Camille recognizes as Rick. He wants to talk to her and says it will only take a minute. And while David watches jealously, a dude hands him some items with a bunch of straps and says he wants it wrapped. Apparently, Donna sells an item of lingerie that costs almost $400. I have a million questions about this. Like,
yeah. My notes are like, Donna lingerie harness $378.86K. Like, yeah. I just, what?
What? Also, like, we have been given to understand the store sells Donna's designs.
Yeah.
And lingerie is a specialized thing. Like, you don't just do it when the rest of the time you're trying to make men's jorts or whatever the fuck she was doing with that line. Like, you know, just because people do both on Project Runway does not mean that real designers
always suck at it. So, no.
Still keeping an eye on Camille and Rick, David comments that it's a lot of money to spend for a Valentine's gift, and the customer says it's a special occasion, something she wouldn't get for herself, and he can't very well just get her a card. David tries to get the guy to agree that less is more, but the guy's all, not on this planet, and then watches. David watches as Camille takes a jewelry box from Rick and opens it to reveal a watch, which he can somehow see, which she hands back to him before coming back to the doorway and saying she needs a little more time, but claims everything is okay. And Rick leads her off with a possessive hand on her back. Gross move when you are not dating a person. while David stares and has to be reminded to finish wrapping the customer's gift, but still takes a second to look at the Valentine he made for Camille and then embarrassedly put it away. Later, Gina goes to the store looking for Donna and is surprised to find David there. Instead of talking about her problems, which we will get to, he makes her perform the emotional labor of advising him about Camille and her watch with crazy eyes. Gina wants to know what the guy looked like. David says, successful, I guess because he was in a suit. I don't know. Or that he bought jewelry. One plus the other adds up to successful, I suppose. And how long Camille has been gone, which has been over 2 hours. David knows down to the minute. Very chill. Gina teases him, but with kind of an edge, about Camille fucking this guy in his mansion. And David is upset, thinking that's what is actually happening. And Gina then regards the $350 top David is apparently planning to get Camille from Donna's store. Although I feel like he could just take it and Donna would never know. I doubt her inventory control is that strong.
Seriously.
David whines that his competition has a bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel, he assumes. And Gina watches with alarm as David continues spinning out. And sometime later, Camille finds her way back to the store, apologizing for how long it took her to deal with Rick, her ex. But David cuts her off to say he got her a gift. And there's a brief misunderstanding before she makes sure he knows she does not like Rick. They broke up a long time ago, but he still insists on giving her an expensive gift every year. Not having realized she is grossed out by big gestures like that, especially on Valentine's Day, the most personal holiday of all. That makes no sense and is meaningless.
Also, he's stalking you? Tell him to fuck off. Stop accepting the gifts. Stop having any contact with him.
Exactly.
Hello?
This does get David, however, to put a magazine down to cover his gift for her and give her his handmade Valentine instead, which is very half-assed. Which you can see in the visual aids, of course. She says it's perfect, and then he lies that the $350 top is for his sister, and they have this exchange, clip two.
You know what? You're the best.
You. The best.
This is like the lowest tea exchange in television history. You know what? You're the best. No, you're the best. It's like Frankenstein singing Merry Christmas on SNL. Like, can we mm-hmm. not bother if this is going to be the energy level? Just stop. Stop the show.
Well, we'll get to our B plot in a second. But first, we have a message for Brooksony.
Alicia tells us that her sister, Brooksony, is an amazing attorney in the D.C. area. She was the youngest partner ever at her last firm and recently left it for a new one that had been recruiting her for years because she's just that good.
For Brooksony's belated birthday, Alicia wanted us to compare her to Matt Durning, Pride of Hamilton Law, and make a list of the five ways she outshines him as an attorney. Easy.
Number one, Brooksony would probably figure out how to use a rich recidivist client like Dylan not only to pay herself a generous salary, but also underwrite all kinds of pro bono work.
Number two, Brooksony would know to specialize in either prenups or capital appeals, not both.
Three, unlike Matt, Brooksony understands that a retainer check is not mad money you can spend on whatever you feel like, no matter how inadequate your fiancé's privileged background makes you feel.
Number four proceeds directly from number three. Brooksony has never been suspended.
And five, if Brooksony had ever been suspended, which would not happen, she would understand that suspension is actually kind of a big deal and not violate the terms of her suspension by lawyering while suspended, thus getting herself double suspended, like Matt, the idiot.
From all of us here and from her sister Alicia,
happy belated birthday, Brooksony!
On to the B plot. Donna's got serious Gina business and goofy game show stuff. Matt is so bored by his suspension that he wants to celebrate Valentine's Day by making Kelly join him as a contestant on Lover's Lane, a copyright-cleared version of the Newlywed Game. Donna is also present for this conversation and really wants them to do it because she watches the show. Later, Gina comes hustling into the store to tell Donna that Dr. Martin just called her out of the blue to ask her to dinner despite not having talked to her at all since Christmas. Donna excuses his silence by claiming that he and Felice have been traveling a lot, whereas the last we heard, it sounded like Donna wasn't talking to them either. That was my impression, anyway.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Well, when asked, Donna tacitly confirms that her parents have been in touch with her. So then Donna suggests that Dr. Martin was waiting to reach out to Gina until Felice went out of town alone, and then gives Gina some tips on dinner dates with Dr. Martin. Clip 3.
Yeah, he's going to take you to Thai Steakhouse on Beverly. He'll order a shrimp cocktail and a filet. Just talk about the Lakers. Tell him how you favor a flat tax. It'll go great.
Yeah, but if he's just killing time, Gina, he's a good guy.
Yeah.
Well, I hope so. It's just that, you know, I've missed having a dad for so long. I just hope that he doesn't turn out to be anything other than that.
Ew.
Yeah. I don't get what she's getting at. It kind of implies that she thinks he's taking her out, like, on a date.
Yeah. I mean, I am so tired of this story and only the fact that it's about to end forever.
Spoiler.
Is any comfort. But I will say that even with all the, like, faffing around, Vanessa Marcil is very winning and sweet in this storyline. It just should have been over, like, 6 months ago. So
I agree, she does the best anyone could with it. I also love the description of dinner with dad, because that is an extremely dadly dinner.
Like the flat tax throwaway line was really funny.
I also think, like, describing this and given Gina's worries, like, an easy way for Donna to help this situation would be like, why don't I go with you, you know? But
yeah,
anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So then Kelly and Matt discuss where they're going to have dinner for Valentine's Day, depending on whether they win the game or not, when the show comes back on and they go to the living room to watch with Janet. And oh my God, the host of the show is a pre-American Idol Ryan Seacrest.
Oh my God. And except for his teeth, he basically looks the same.
Yeah, his hair is also, like, much crazier than it is now.
Oh, I mean, yeah, no, super 90s spiky. Or, like,
frosty.
Turn of the odds, spiky, gel,
but yeah,
situation.
It's true. He has not aged. It's surprising. One of the couples in the finals fails to match on what first attracted him to her. She says her mind, he says her body, and they start fighting. Kelly is still not sure she wants to do this, even though the taping is tomorrow. Not how TV works. Until she finds out they could win $25,000. Over to dinner with Gina and Dr. Martin, which is awkward. Apparently, she hasn't given up on skating. She thinks it's given up on her. But he saw the Olympic trials on TV and thought she was great. Clip 4.
I came in fourth.
Fourth? Gina, you were fourth in the entire United States. Come on.
Yeah, tell that to my mother. She said it was your idea to keep it a secret.
When she decided to go through with the pregnancy, we came to an arrangement.
And she decided. So you wanted her to end it.
Oh, Gina, no, I never even suggested that.
But you didn't tell her not to either.
Gina, it was her choice. I told her I would support any decision she made, and I did.
With your arrangement. You know, a lot of fathers used to come and watch their daughters skate. I know, because I used to stare at their faces. They always looked so proud. I used to pick one and pretend he was mine.
Get therapy!
I don't know what to call you.
What about John? A lot of adult kids call their parents by their first name.
Right. John, it is.
I mean, this whole, you know, see my previous comments. Also, this scene is somewhat undercut by, and you will see this in the visual aids, the extremely large and, like, erect leaf of lettuce that is jutting out of his shrimp cocktail.
Yeah.
Which he does not finish. Come on, Dr. Martin. Help us help you.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they're not even being consistent in this story, and it's all happened this season.
I was going to mention that, too. Like, I just don't even know. Like, the terms of the arrangement keep changing to suit whatever Gina is written to be sulking about, which is like, then why bother doing it?
Yeah.
And that they're fixing it by killing off this character, spoiler, is kind of classic, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be different if they were teenagers and it was like from week to week, she was like, I don't want your money, I just want your love, versus I was struggling and blah, blah, blah. It would have made a difference if we had your support. But, you know, she's in her 20s, like, figure it out. Anyway,
yeah.
Then their dishes come. Gina tells him that Donna predicted exactly what he would order, and she gets a huge pile of penne in, like, a soup bowl. Took a picture for the visual aids. Like, I realize that large portions are a problem in American restaurants, but, like, even the Cheesecake Factory has dishes that fit their portions. Like, it's just, it really looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the next thing that he says is that the portions there are huge. True. But Gina thinks it's great that Donna and Dr. Martin know each other that well. And Dr. Martin is sad as the plinky remorseful score. So moving over to the stuff, blessedly. In the green room at the TV studio the next day, Kelly and Matt's insufferable opponents are in matching outfits, while Kelly, in her dowdy maxi skirt, which you can see in the visual aids, pouts that she feels sick. The PA comes in to collect them all and urge them to be energetic on camera, but Kelly is sick to her stomach for real because Donna made her eat egg whites with carrot juice to enhance her memory. Donna, what?
Yeah.
What is also, this goop shit?
Yeah. Also, why? Just don't drink it, Kelly.
Yeah. Use your head. Matt offers to get them out of this, but Kelly says she's going to be fine right before running out to barf. And when Janet goes out after her, the PA is like, Matt, Kelly, are you all right? And Donna snuggles closer to Matt and says, we're fine. And Matt wants the money, so he plays along.
Thus reminding us that Donna and Matt from the jump had way more chemistry.
Yep.
Than Koozie and Matt. And this is like less unfun than it could be, given how stuffy it is. So... Mm-hmm. Sigh.
Yeah, it's not a total lost cause. We'll get back to it. But first, Gina shows up at the Martin manse with a huge bag of groceries, Donna having told her that Dr. Martin likes to eat frozen dinners when Felice is out of town. But when she opens the freezer to put hers away, like two fall out because the freezer is crammed full of them. Make a sandwich, my dude. What the hell? Really? And then it's awkward because the dinners he has our beef stroganoff, and she brought veal piccata and assumes he hates veal, but he over-insists that he actually doesn't. And Gina deflates, saying he's already got lots of women in his life and they actually know what he likes. And he stops her and tells her he really wants this to work. She says he should try calling her more than once every 2 months, and then shoves her bag at him and goes. And on the set of Lover's Lane, Judy and Ron, Donna and Matt's opponents, are totally in sync. Okay. Judy and Ron are not 20-something names in the year 2000. They're just not.
No, they're not. I note, however, that the Lover's Lane set is pretty clever. Mm-hmm. Like, they're seated in, like, their seats are the back seats.
Yeah, of cars.
Of
yeah.
cars.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was clever. Anyway.
Yeah, it's cute. And you'll also see this in the visual aids, that the text on the signs of the contestants' names is, like, totally in the Friends opening credits font too.
Yeah.
It was a time. Anyway,
didn't we have a time?
didn't we just. We find out Ron's nickname for Judy in bed is Athena, not after the Greek goddess, but because it's Ron's mother's name. Okay. Instead of following up on that, Ryan asks,
get therapy.
Seriously. Instead of following up on that, Ryan asks, air quotes, Kelly, where Matt most likes to make whoopee. Donna says, in his law office, and is correct. Kelly and Janet are watching from the green room, and Kelly admits it did happen once. And then Ryan banters in clip 5.
So, Kelly, tell us, exactly what type of legal work does Matt perform for you, huh?
Well, I don't think we need to go there, guy.
Oh, come on. Does he sequester you? Or perhaps hold you in contempt, huh?
Oh, no, we don't do that. But sometimes we play this game, attorney-client privilege.
Do you? Because I don't think Matt knows what any of those terms mean. Certainly don't think he knows what suspension means.
Nope. Anyway, or Janet
dignity.
Cracks...
dignity. Anyway.
Janet cracks up at this while Kelly looks guilty and Matt looks betrayed, so it must be true. And when we pick back up with these idiots, Ron says the one thing he would change about Judy would be her mole. She thought it would be her sense of humor because sometimes she's just too funny. And Ron shits a brick beside her, and they fight about whether it's a mole or a beauty mark and too unsightly for him to look at except in the dark. In the green room, Janet exposits that if Matt and Donna get their next question right, they'll win $25,000. And the question is, who does Kelly consider to be her best friend? Kelly says this is so easy. They're definitely going to win, except stupid Matt says himself. And Kelly, meaning Donna, says her best friend is Donna Martin. This is 100% Matt's fault, by the way. What a fucking idiot. Anyone could have answered this right.
Yeah. Like,
come on. On the
and
set,
then the response to it is so, I don't know, so the rulesy, but anyway.
Oh, I know. Yes. On the set, Matt stews and Kelly braces herself for him somehow taking this out on her, even though she was not involved. Afterward, everyone drives back from the studio while Janet tries to get Matt and Kelly excited about their parting gift, a bread maker that can make four loaves at a time. Donna joins her in marveling at how amazing it is, but it doesn't work. And Matt is still pissed in clip six.
Everyone in America knows about our little sex games in the office, and I get a bread maker out of the deal. So that's a great trade-off.
Okay, this was your idea.
I wanted to do with you, okay? Not your best friend.
I'm sorry, I had food poisoning. I wasn't thinking. If I was thinking, of course I would have said your name.
No, you know what? Donna is my best friend. What is your problem with that?
Oh, wait, I never said I had a problem with that. Did I say I had a problem with that?
You guys lost $25,000. Sorry.
Tell me, is there any intimate detail that you haven't broadcast?
How about this one? You can cancel any dinner plans we had for tonight.
You sure about that? I can get us a table for three. It'll spare you the post-game replay.
Can you please just be quiet for 5 minutes?
Don't ask me. I'm not the one with the problem being quiet.
Oh, my God. Matt.
Don't make me side with Kelly, fucking baby.
Honestly, like, I don't even know which part you're mad at that she didn't say that she thinks you're her best friend or that she told her actual best friend about sex stuff because women talk. Like, is this the first woman you've ever dated? Deal with it.
Seriously, you were married before. Are you kidding? Ugh, God.
Yeah.
And that so, this is a plot line too. Oh man, just break up. You hate each other.
Indeed. After finding David at the store instead of Donna, whom she had actually been looking for, Gina listens to all of David's bullshit, which we already covered, and then asks him to give Donna the message that she tried with Dr. Martin, and she failed, adding, as usual.
Ugh.
Donna later finds Kelly on the deck, reading the manual to the bread maker, which I didn't even notice, but Sarah clocked for the visual aids. It was so good.
I mean, like, classic Kelly to just have a, like, performative sulk while reading an instruction manual on the deck of brooding and, you know, critical conversations. Like,
right. But it's the fact that it's the manual for the bread maker. It's like, okay, at least it ties it in that she's like, oh, what the fuck? We got a bread maker. I'll figure out how to use it. I like bread. I don't know.
I like bread.
Yeah. Kelly announces that she hates Valentine's Day. Does she, though? They then get into debating whether it's okay for Kelly to confide in Donna. Duh, of course it is. And whether Kelly's husband should be her friend. This is dumb. Kelly calls Donna her safety net in case everything goes to hell, which Donna thinks is a bad attitude to have going into a marriage. But she's not wrong. I feel like most friendships probably outlive most marriages in one way or another, especially between women, since men die first. Like, have we learned nothing from the Golden Girls? Hello?
I mean, since our marriage is both, like, I don't know, maybe we're bad examples, but it's like, right. Have we also not all learned that, like, it's pretty rare to have one person be your only person?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's not a competition.
No, it's not. Anyway. Donna encourages Kelly to learn to confide in Matt. No one cares. Gina opens the door to her hotel room to find Dr. Martin, whom she stiffly greets as John. He's thought a lot about what she said, how she thinks there's no room for her in her life, and says when Donna was a kid, he used to let her watch while he performed surgery so that she could understand what he did and what it meant, and they discuss that in clip 7.
You take a person with a bad heart and you give him another chance.
I guess it must be weird going to sleep thinking that you're going to die, and then you just wake up with a whole new life.
Well, it's a little bit like going to sleep thinking that your father is one person, and then he turns out to be someone entirely different. But you see, neither one of them work unless you really try.
I hate calling you John.
Then you call me Dad. I'd be so honored.
Yeah? Dad. I like that.
Me too.
See what I mean? This is like way better acting than this deserves, having been stretched to taffy thinness over the entire season.
Yep. Cut to Dr. Martin the next day, panting on the phone with Donna because he's in the middle of a training session with Gina. And they are going for dinner later. Dr. Martin invites Donna to join them. Donna hears Gina call Dr. Martin dad and is touched. Kelly, later, shows up at the Walsh house to tell Matt that the show was idiotic, but telling Donna everything was pretty idiotic, too. No, it's not.
Disagree.
Stop saying this. Matt says he knows how close Donna and Kelly are and that he respects their friendship. Kelly knows things between her and Donna need to change, though they don't, and she's sorry she didn't think of that before. She then gives Matt his Valentine's Day gift, her journal, for him to read.
Wow. Way to punish him.
Oh my God.
Remember the last time we got a look at her journal?
Oh my God, seriously.
Oh my God. The Allison files. Nope.
She claims she's been writing in one since she was a little girl, but I thought she got it as a gift from Val.
She did.
Okay. Like 2 Christmases ago? Okay.
Nice show, Bible. Way to read it.
Matt claims to be touched, but gives it back, saying he doesn't want to read it because of course he doesn't. This is extremely weird. Even best friends shouldn't share everything, he says. And he's not going to let her read his journal either. She teases that he's given up gold, and a dumb chase around the couch ensues. So that's where we leave that, I guess. Then the doorbell rings at the Martin manse. Gina appears from somewhere, bellowing to Dr. Martin to answer it because it's probably Donna. He doesn't answer, which is when Gina finds him keeled over at the foot of the stairs. She can't rouse him, and when she opens the door, it is Donna who screams at Gina to call 911, which is where we leave things with Dr. Martin and both his children that we know of. Do you ring the doorbell at your parents' house? Like, do you not just, like, maybe knock and then come in when they know you're coming? That was weird to me.
Yeah. No, I just let myself in. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the last place my parents lived was in an apartment building, so their doorman would call up and they knew we were coming, but yeah.
I could see Felice being Felice-y about that, though. So
fair enough.
Yeah.
On to our A-plot. Dylan must rescue Noah from his stupid kidnapping and proceeds stupidly. Steve is hanging out in Dylan's suite waiting for a basketball game to start when Josie shows up and tells Dylan she thinks her brother did something crazy, kidnapping Noah. She recaps the story thus far and explains that Shane thinks this will force Dylan to give him the money the family needs to repay Josie's drug debt. Dylan is dubious that Shane could pull off something as complicated as a kidnapping, as though Noah is hard to nab. You could just put a shot under a cardboard box propped up with a stick. I mean, right? Thank you so much.
I'm just imagining that it would be like a huge box too, like a refrigerator box. He'd be like, what in here?
Yeah. Hey, but Josie says that Shane has been watching Dylan. He knows Dylan has money and a goddaughter. Steve overhears that last part, which, by the way, means he also heard that Noah's been kidnapped and, like, didn't care. Anyway, when Steve comes to the door, Josie says that Shane has been by the Walsh house, and Dylan and Steve squint at her, which you can see I made a gif. Next, we see Steve driving with Dylan in the passenger seat. Steve has Janet on the phone confirming that Maddie is fine, but not why he's actually asking. Cool marriage. Then Dylan calls Kelly at the beach apartment to see if she's seen Noah. She hasn't. And when she asks Matt and Donna if they have, they ignore her. Hilarious. Dylan claims it's just club stuff and doesn't leave a message. David at his place says he hasn't seen Noah either and assumed he fell asleep at the office at the club. So when Steve and Dylan get to the Peach Pit After Dark parking lot, they confirm that Noah's car is still there and figured David was probably right. But when Dylan goes inside the club to look, Steve sees the damage on Noah's car. And yet, despite the story, they're in the process of investigating. Steve still is not 100 on what's going on. Clip 8.
This is a joke, right? Some kind of prank?
I don't know.
There's your joke.
Yeah. And I love that Dylan's still, like, his voice, like, I don't know. Like, he doesn't really care either, but he's just curious to see how this plays out. Anyway, no one's
worried.
Yeah,
I kind of, like, I just don't exactly understand why anyone gives a shit at this point. Yeah, like, just,
seriously.
Just call the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
No. TV.
Yeah. So, then we find out this episode is directed by Brian Austin Green. Yikes. Cut to a loft in a rough part of town, which we can tell because there's a train whistle outside. Noah is cuffed to a pipe or something and scoffing at the idea that Dylan will pay $1 million for him. I joined in that scoff, by the way.
Yeah, same. Also, Noah serving extremely tidy, kidnappy, like voguing realness in his thermal undershirt and like jazz hands. All right, dude, settle down.
Yeah, he is blue stealing real hard in this scene.
Yeah.
But, I mean, maybe there is a circumstance under which Dylan would manage to find $1 million to ransom Noah because clip 9.
Your pal's worth $200 million.
Oh, God. Are we really going to try and nail this number down again?
Yeah, please. Sure. Fine. Who cares?
If that's true, Dylan should have bought Gina a chain of gyms by now for all his fuckery. But it turns out that amount is according to Noah's bragging on Dylan's behalf, which he would now like to retract, claiming he was messing with them. The upshot is that if Shane doesn't get the money, he's going to kill Noah. Noah glares blue steelfully. So when Dylan knows that, he will be sure to cough it up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dylan finds Josie and her leopard pants in the hotel bar and demands to know where Shane is. She doesn't know and has just been waiting for him to call her. So then we get Shane's backstory for some reason, which is that he was a successful child star at 15, but now fixes cars at age 28. Like, suggesting that this come down turned him into a kidnapper is extremely condescending to people who do both of those jobs. And actually, all three, I'm going to include kidnappers among the people this anecdote is disrespectful to, by the way.
Yeah.
Anyway, Dylan then calls Shane from Josie's phone and leaves a message telling Shane to call him. The phone in Dylan's room later is ringing when he walks in. It is Shane delivering the ransom demand on the phone, just
on a landline. Good job.
Yep. Dylan needs to see Noah first. Shane tells him to check his email. Now, my first reaction was, holy shit, we were sending photos in email in February 2000, but Dylan does check his email. And it's not even a photo. It's an AVI, which is broken.
It's Noah.AVI. Yeah.
And it's broken per the thumbnail, which you can see in the visual aids. But then it starts to play anyway, clip 10.
Hey, Dylan. Tomorrow, too, I want you to drive east on the 10 towards Vegas, and I'll call you in your car. I know you can afford it, so let's keep things simple. No cops. You ever see Deer Hunter? Best Picture, 78. De Niro, Chris Walken. Had some nice moments. This is my favorite, though. Didn't go off. Don't test my resolve, McKay. Your pal here, he's not that lucky. I've got nothing to lose.
Except that Canadian accent.
So many people have been kidnapped on the show. When you think back, it's really a lot.
Yeah.
And
any of them just get killed, please?
Honestly.
This is an excellent time to start. Never too late.
Yes. Like, who would have cared if Noah got killed? He wasn't even dating anyone in the gang at this point. Like,
yeah.
Who
even Noah's like, you know what? I'm set. Just let's end this.
Seriously. But Dylan then apparently waits until the next day to have Steve over to show him the ransom video. Dylan tells Steve he's going to get Shane his money. Steve figures the cops can put a tracking device in the cash and somehow is shocked to learn that Dylan hasn't gone to the cops about this at all. Dylan makes Steve promise to cover for him while he's dealing with the handoff, and Steve agrees, but not without warning that Dylan's superhero complex is going to get someone killed. Shane leaves that other weird nameless henchman to watch Noah while Shane himself goes to get the cash from Dylan. The henchman sits down like 5 miles away from a tiny black and white TV. Noah asks him to turn it up a little so the guys won't notice Noah's noise as he attempts to free himself. So then Dylan is waiting with the money in the bar at the hotel where he lives, And Steve sees fit to unzip the duffel bag that the cash is in and look at it while people are just like walking by his table. Like it's a crowded coffee shop. It's insane.
Oh,
anyway, Steve can't believe Dylan's going to pay $1 million for the life of someone he doesn't even like. And Dylan agrees that he doesn't like Noah, LOL, but that he's doing it for the people he likes who like Noah. Who is left? Would have
been so funny if you were like, that's a good point. And then like started removing packs of money from the duffel bag. It's like, what are we down to, like 800 grand? Yeah, that's fine. That's enough.
So Steve wants to go back Dylan up on the handoff, but Dylan reminds him that he has a wife and a child, who, by the way, have been threatened. Like, no one has mentioned that in a while.
Mm.
And then Josie shows up, and Dylan goes with her into an elevator while Steve continues blawing instructions like he knows any more about this than Dylan does. He does, however, pledge to call the police if Dylan doesn't reach him with regular updates from the road to Las Vegas. And finally tells Dylan not to be an idiot, but then the elevator doors close, and they are gone. And in the hotel's underground parking garage, Josie tells Dylan how sorry she is about all this. And he tells her to stop apologizing and is so street smart that he just walks ahead of her with this bag of cash and is oblivious as she stays behind him and pulls a gun out of her purse. And Shane gets out of a nearby van, also with a gun, and tells Dylan to get in. I don't get this plan. Do they think they can hold him for ransom and get more money from someone else who also has $200 million? Like, surely they know everyone else in the gang is broke.
Yeah. Or like just take the money and leave.
Yeah.
Like you're done. You got the money.
Yeah. Noah will figure out how to break that pipe in time.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you sent a video, like someone will be able to figure out where he is.
Yeah.
Whatever. This, alas, is not over. There is more to get to. But first, we have a birthday message for Tallman from his wife, Gwen. Gwen tells us that Tallman worked in Washington, D.C. for 20 years, so she thought it would be fun for us to list 5 reasons Brandon and his boorish behavior would get him impeached, disgraced, or censured/indicted were he to serve in Congress.
We're doing this ad for a guy named Tallman. Perfect. look, as a resident of the raffish New York 11th, I am here to tell you that it is not necessarily as easy to get rid of the local representative jackass as proving he broke the law, but we're certainly with the spirit of the thing, so here are 5 humiliating things that might happen to Mr. Walsh after he goes to Washington. Number 1. At a retired congressperson's pickup basketball game, he is mistaken for the ball by former NBA player and Maryland rep Tom McMillan and dunked authoritatively.
Number 2. Thinks his interview at the Clinton Foundation went really well, only to find it wasn't the former president he dazzled with his insights, but the same impersonator the show hired to congratulate him for task forcing.
Did he not think it was odd that they were meeting at a Starbucks in Bethesda? Anyway, number 3, his liberal kind of guy editorial for the Washington Post is met with such universal derision that he's obliged to go back to writing obits in Boston for free.
Number 4, Speaker Pelosi mistakes his shelf hair for the sound block of her ceremonial gavel, rests the gavel there, and watches in horror as it sinks into pomade quicksand. The resulting tussle to free it, involving 3 Senate pages and a Norelco borrowed off a tourist from Cedar Rapids, goes viral.
And finally, number 5. After visitors to the Election 2020 office report an incensed imp in giant sneakers and a Twins jersey braying, "You took the job!" at the lobby directory, Brandon is subdued with a novelty fly swatter and treated for dehydration and exhaustion.
Tallman, Brandon's mortification is Gwen's gift to you, and really a gift to us all, so thank you for letting us share in it. From all of us here at Again With This,
happy birthday, Tallman!
Back to the kidnapping of the guy no one cares about. From the back of the van, Dylan reminds Josie that she heard Steve, who's probably called the cops by now, except they're not going to Vegas. They're going in the opposite direction, which, given that they're in LA, I guess means driving into the ocean. Dylan is pretty sure that the cops will just look for them somewhere else. Given that Dylan has violated his probation like 50 times, I might not assume the cops would try that hard to find him when he's the one in trouble. But the more he talks, the more Josie seems to wonder if he's right that they haven't covered their tracks, like, at all. So they bring Dylan to the same hideout where they're holding Noah and lock him to the same pipe, telling the nameless henchman to let Dylan join his little girlfriend. Rude. Dylan, just as rudely, says that if Shane had shown that strong a sense of humor, his show would have never gotten canceled. He also tells Noah he paid, which Noah assumes means Shane will be letting them go now, even though he just finished watching Dylan also get cuffed to the pipe. But Shane says no, and Josie's like, what? Like, why did she participate in this plan if she didn't know what it was? Turns out Shane knows that the sentence for kidnapping with a weapon is life in prison, the same as if he killed Noah and Dylan. So guess what? Josie, the fucking idiot, looks alarmed. And I am for real furious about how stupid all of this is.
It's just so... it's just so dull.
It's like a kid even, wrote it. It's like kid logic of how this would go down if it was going to go
like
bad.
They can't even... They're doing some of the cliches of a kidnapping plot, but like they're doing them wrong.
Yeah. Later, Shane gives Nameless Hench the bag of cash by the van while inside Noah and Dylan, totally unattended, work together to pull the pipe out from its fitting. Shane sends Hench in to bring out their captives. Noah jumps him. Even though the lair door is wide open, neither Josie nor Shane sees or hears anything, Josie telling Shane they did this to get out of trouble, not to get into worse trouble. While Noah holds Hench, Dylan knocks him out and tells Noah to get the keys. Shane tells Josie they have no choice but to kill Noah and Dylan, and she just wanders off smoking. So is murder really that big a stretch for her? I mean, she's smoking a cigarette on television. She's a villain. Anyway,
she has resting duck face, so that does not help.
She kind of does. She soon tosses said cigarette, however, when she notices that Dylan is free and yells to Shane to look out. Shane jumps into the van driver's seat, barely holding his gun with his fingertips. Several very improbable scuffles ensue while the gas that Shane was filling the van with starts spilling everywhere. And Josie just points her gun at everyone uselessly, eventually shooting the air to get everyone's attention. She tells Shane they're not killers and she just wants this to be over. While Dylan tries to talk Josie into giving him her gun, the gas pools toward the cigarette. Shane also tries to get Josie to do what he wants, but Dylan gets to her first, and it was just taking the gun out of her hand when the cigarette ignites the gas. I don't know how burny that cigarette still would be. I doubt the physics of that, but okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't either. Dylan shoves Josie away while Noah yells at him about the money, and Dylan tells him to forget about it. Maybe he really does have $200 million, you guys, if he could be that cavalier about $1 million in cash. While Dylan rounds up the miscreants with his one gun, Noah gets the cash bag out of the van, runs off, and dives like a full second before the van explodes. It's very, very dumb. Noah tosses the cash to Dylan. Josie is now standing next to Dylan because I guess she's switched sides again and there's no reason they shouldn't trust her. Back in Dylan's suite, Steve recaps, leave it to the professionals, that Noah and Dylan will both have to testify when Shane and Josie go on trial. Duh. But I guess the point is to let us know Dylan did eventually go to the cops. Apparently, he's not being charged with vigilantism, however. Noah stares out the window while Vincent Young tries his best to look haunted, which mainly just involves squinting. And I'm so glad he didn't get killed? Question mark? Like, what a nothing. You're so close to the end. Just ax this guy. No one cares.
Yeah, really.
But they
did. Why ax? Like, ax him. Like, if you need a big funeral for the final season, kill him. Instead of poor Dr. Martin, who survived this long.
I know. Ugh. Well,
anyway,
let's close it up by naming our episode MVP. I'm going to say Vanessa Marcel for the reason that you said. She acted the hell out of her storyline, considering how dumb it is.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. And I will add Seacrest. Already on brand, even as a like teenager.
You know, you can even tell in that clip of him bantering, like he's locked in. He's not my cup of tea, but you can tell why he is successful at what he does.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Like, you may not care to consume what he does, but he is the best at it. And he, I mean, I don't think he sleeps. So
no, he works.
Somewhere Dunkelman is sharpening a pin.
Oh, Doug.
Sorry, buddy.
Rest in power. Just kidding. He's still alive. Least valuable player. Camille, don't you have anything better to do than hang around Donna's store not getting paid? Get a life.
And like wanting to make out with David apparently, but then not doing it?
Yeah.
But I'm still going to say Shane.
Yeah, that's fair.
His hair is terrible. This kidnapping plot is idiotic and a failure.
Yep. Yeah, that's fair.
Like, you can make actually excellent money fixing cars. I wish I knew how to do that. It's more lucrative than writing for a living. Trust.
Let's do the Kim challenge.
Bad, bad, and dangerous to me.
Five ways from this episode, Dylan proves he is mad, bad, and dangerous to know. Well, it's bad not to go to the cops when your friend or frenemy gets kidnapped.
Yeah. I mean, it's also mad to involve yourself in this when you actively dislike him. I know it's your business partner, but that's not your preference. So,
but he's not. They're not business partners. We don't know what their arrangement is. Like, we've talked about this ad nauseum, too. Like, whatever they are doing at the club is not formalized in any kind of way.
All right. They're like part. I mean, they're adjacent at work.
They're colleagues. Yeah. Whatever. It's dangerous to involve your friend who is married and has a child in this kidnapping plan you're keeping off the books.
It's mad, bad, and dangerous to precede a fellow member of any kidnapping plot to the car holding an entire duffel bag of some of your 200 millions.
Yeah, it's probably dangerous to have access to that much cash on hand. Like, I even, especially in the past, like, I feel like this should be invested in a much safer way. And I'm concerned that you're going to lose it all again because you're dumb.
Mm, yeah.
That makes five.
Sure does. Next time on Again With This Melrose Place edition, the show remembers Jane's supposed to be pregnant. Just kidding. It doesn't. Here's what we are laboring through instead. Sandy scores a role in a horror movie, but it's her zero to diva in 60 seconds routine that's really scaring everyone. And Billy's dad pressures him to join the family furniture business, presumably because he does such a convincing impression of wooden objects.
Yeah.
You'll be doing a convincing impression of a poisoned object when you get a load of our visual aids for this and every other episode of Again With This. You can find those on our website, againwiththis.com, and some of those show up on our Twitter account. That's AWT90210. If you'd like to treat us to some eye drops and yourself to bonus content about 90210 and Melrose, stop by our Patreon page at patreon.com/againwiththis. I'm Ransom Birkin, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is Killer Workout Tara Ariano. She's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And scrupulously observing producer-client privilege is David T. Cole. Talk to you next time.
Hi, you know what to do after the beeparoonie.
16.